Welcome to Writers on Writing. I'm your host, Marie Stone. Today, my guest is poet Donna Hilbert. Donna is the author of 9 collections of poetry, 2 works of fiction. She joined me to talk about her latest collection, Threnody, how she constructs poems, advice for poetry students, and more. Enjoy the conversation. Donna, welcome back.
What a pleasure to be here.
So you are one of my favorite grief poets. And I've said several times throughout the pandemic that I found myself reading more poetry than I had before, kind of for that reason. I mean, I just feel like poets are kind of world wiser to me. And so when I saw the title of your latest collection, Threnody, which literally means lament, right? I thought maybe, you know, we could just open with this conversation about grief and lament, because it feels like the right time for that, given, I was going to say, given what we've been through, but I will now say, given what we're still going through. And I know you had a relationship with grief well before the pandemic that I know informed your work for a long time. And maybe we can talk about that. But I would just love to talk about the kind of this shape-shifting nature of grief and how it's informed your work for decades, and maybe how you feel like that relationship changed during the pandemic to give rise to this collection. Do you kind of feel like grief has been one of the most informative aspects of how you think about your work?
Well, yes. I certainly would never have intended for it to be that way. But, you know, if you live long enough and love hard enough, you will have a lot of grief in your life. And we live in a society that tries to ignore that. And I don't think really knows how to act in the face of grief. And I guess I want to be a part of allowing people to speak of it. People are always asking me if my writing is therapeutic for me. I would say, you know, no, it's not. Therapy is therapeutic for me. And my writing is, you know, it's my art, but it comes out of my daily life. And when my daily life is informed by grief, where else do I go with it?
I wasn't familiar with your poetry. So your husband was killed in a bicycle accident in 1998. And you'd been writing, by that time, you'd been writing poetry for 20 years.
Not quite 20, but close to 20. I'd had, 2 books of poetry published by then. Before that, I wrote about, started out with my family of origin, and really until people didn't want to speak to me there. And then I moved on to his family. And so I guess his death got me off my childhood a bit, or my young, was practically a child when we were married. So they got a break after that, a terrible price to pay, but life moves forward. I don't usually call it an accident because he was killed by a driver under the influence. Although I have great empathy for how it tore up his family as well as my own.
And you still write about it to this day. There's some really great poems that I hope we get to explore in here about him.
Well, I will never stop writing about him, I'm sure, because everything he's missed, horrible and wonderful, think of him. One poem that just came like a flash of lightning to me was on the 7th game of the World Series, I have a one-day breakdown. Now here, this, you know, was the last time the Dodgers were in the World Series 7th game. I don't remember what year, but not that long ago, what, 5 years ago, something like that. I was to do a reading that night, and I woke up in the morning knowing it was the 7th game and how we'd raised our kids at Dodger Stadium, basically. I started crying and I could not stop. And so for the second time in my life as a poet, I canceled a reading. The first time was when I dropped a piece of fish into hot oil on a Sunday night. And the next day I had an appointment with the doctor and I told him, you got to make, you know, do something because I have a reading tonight. And what he did was called the burn center and said, you can't go anywhere with a face like that. So I canceled that reading too. It was, you know, I didn't go to the doctor for the burn, but at any rate, I don't cancel yes. readings. That's the point. But I did. And then that poem came out of that experience. So these things just live with you.
Well, I wonder if we can enter the collection through that poem. Maybe you read that poem, and then in the aftermath of that, we can kind of talk about this collection as a whole and, you know, what period of time these poems were written over. But I think this is kind of a lovely introduction to Threnody.
Seventh game of the World Series, and I have a one-day breakdown. How about them Dodgers? Your rhetorical changeup from politics or personal line drive to the gut. Why won't you say you love me? Why don't you call your mother? My questions, then your question. How about them Dodgers? We don't talk about the ways our parents fouled us, or worse, strikeout after strikeout of our own. See the ball, hit the ball. You taught our children, lesson enough, I wonder. But oh, those hot dog and peanut eating evenings, the cotton candy sky dissolving to deep blue, us in the stadium with our crew, spring, summer, sometimes fall. See the ball, hit the ball. How about them Dodgers? Think they'll make it to the fall? I'm told that's what you were saying when you biked into the sunrise, when the errant driver didn't see you, didn't see that he would hit you, and your season, end your season in the summer. How about them Dodgers?
How long after that day did you start working on this?
Probably the next morning, or maybe even that night. I don't even really, and this is odd for me, I don't really remember the process that much. It just came.
Well, I was just going to say, because there are so many dual ways the language works in all of your poems, but certainly in this one as well, and the see and the hit. For those listening, you can't see the very elegant italicized words here, but this resonance, I don't know over what period of time it takes you as the poet to see those lovely resonance and the way words can work on, you know, how your parents fouled you. I assume that comes through revision, but I don't know. Maybe it just comes.
It usually comes through revision, but I don't think it did in this case. And probably the reason for that is on my husband's, you know, the stone on his graveside is see the ball, hit the ball, because he was an athlete and he coached our children in every sport. And when he was coaching baseball, which was not a sport he played, but it was a sport we watched constantly, he would say to the children, see the ball, hit the ball. And it was just what he said. And so we spent so much time, we had season tickets for the Dodgers, and you know, we spent so much time with baseball. The language of baseball was very much a part of my language. So I do not remember the struggle in this poem. I really don't. Yeah. There are other poems I can tell you when I more about the process, but this, and I have to say, here is something when I'm writing, I am plugged into somebody way smarter than I am, or something. You know, things happen that I am not aware of making happen. I don't know what it means. And I write with a pen and paper, which I think is very helpful.
I've talked to a lot of writers about that recently. And the act of longhand, I think, does several things. First of all, it takes away the inclination to edit on the computer screen, which seems so permanent and so daunting.
I think it is the worst thing a writer can do, frankly. I cannot bear it when I see it. I was giving a workshop in right on Door County where I am privileged to have a residence, and somebody, they were starting to take out the computers, and I said, no, not in here. Pencil and paper, pen and paper. Right. I just don't know. But I could go so much faster. That's the point. You're going too fast.
Yeah, and I imagine it gives you a little bit more freedom to play on the page as a poet of crossing things out, but you can still see what was there before, right? So you can still come back to something or
absolutely
play with punctuation. Yeah, yeah,
absolutely. I seldom go back to anything crossed out, but occasionally I do, because Yeah, I can't. I just, it's so foreign to me to anybody could actually do anything other than email, you know, on the computer. I do not get it. I don't care, left-handed or right-handed, you can't read your handwriting, whatever, you can make it big. You can use big, giant pieces of paper and a crayon if you need, but for heaven's sakes, not on a screen. Screens are full of distraction.
Well, let's talk about the collection and the period. It's interesting because you were on the show in 2018 with Gravity.
And that's right.
I can certainly see your fingerprints, you know, your voice all over both collections, but talk a little bit about the period of time over which these were written and, you know, where your thinking went, because the world certainly went in a very different direction from 2018.
Oh my gosh.
And I assume your creative brain did too.
Well, I probably wrote maybe a half a dozen poems before the pandemic that have ended up in, I mean, I write a lot of things that I would never even send out, and just garbage, and you know, they don't go anywhere and I forget about them. So this was written, except for just a handful of poems, during the pandemic. And I have never, I mean, this was very fast coming to fruition. I was adding poems to it until the very last minute, because there was a reason for that, because the publisher, in order to get my name on the spine, needed the book to be a certain length. So, I mean, I wanted my name on the spine for, you know, obvious reasons. So I just kept writing and revising, and then we added photos. And I think after he accepted the manuscript, I added maybe three poems that just managed to come together, and sent them off to one of my favorite journals. And I mean, at the very last minute, and I took them and made it into the book, and I was like, yay. But so much time at home, to answer the question, I, you know, didn't go anywhere for a year. Right. I sat on my back porch and fed crows and listened to my neighbors. And I would get up every morning and take a walk. I would think, when I was feeling sorry for myself, what would Mary Oliver do? Well, she'd get up and take a walk. So you can do that too.
I love that. What would Mary Oliver do? I love that. Those are words to live by. What would Mary?
I think
WW.
So.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it beats the other ones that I've heard. What would so-and-so or whatever do?
Right.
Yeah. Mary Oliver. So I learned a lot more about my neighborhood, the ecology, the birds that live here. And that has been a really positive thing. The title of the book came from something that I observed in the neighborhood, and the poem, I changed the title because I thought nobody's going to buy a book named Dirge. They're going to know what they're getting into immediately. So with Threnody, at least, you know, they're going to think about it and then perhaps look it up. They'll, you know, the end will be the same, but a prettier word.
It's a beautiful word. I confess I did have to look it up, but it's a beautiful
word.
Well, yeah.
Of course. Yeah. Don't go around with Greek on the tips of our tongues.
Do not. Not yeah. Well, we do now with the pandemic, but yes, no, we did not before.
Really, no.
So it's interesting because I was thinking about how the pandemic almost mirrors your approach to poetry, which is to go very slow, right? And to be very conscious about how you're living your life, kind of this forced slowdown. And I thought, for poets who already live pretty intentionally and pretty slowly, most of the poets I know do, what that would do to your process to have to slow down even more, right? To have to pay even closer attention than you already do.
Well, I have to say that was pretty wonderful, because now I have an excuse. I mean, you know what I really hate, and I love my friends dearly, so it's not about that, but I hate going out to lunch because it interrupts my whole day. I have to get out of the jammy, you know, I'm out of my jammies because I'm walking, but sometimes I don't have on like substantial, you know, undergarments or whatever.
right.
So now, with that, I mean, I didn't have to make any excuses, you know. It's not like, I love you, I don't like lunch. So I just, you know, I have my whole day. And I really liked that. What I hated was not seeing my family. I do like to go out for dinner, so that's not a problem. I like the solitude. I mean, it was great.
Well, let's get into a few of these. We were exchanging emails before the show, and I had not appreciated the poetry of the apostrophe. I hadn't come across that word in poetry before. I haven't studied poetry. And I thought that was really interesting. And after you alerted me to that, I went back again through the collection. And you're right, there are so many of these poems that are apostrophes. And I wondered if you could talk about that concept, and maybe we can talk about a few of the examples in here. But what a lovely structure that I didn't know about.
There's nothing like teaching a class to kind of organize your thinking around something that you know on one level, but don't necessarily know what it's called or what it does. I teach a lot of workshops, day long or several hour workshops, where I like to present examples of, you know, how you might write a particular kind of poem. And I didn't even realize how many apostrophes I had in this collection until I went to put my hand out together. And of course, the ones that say dear somebody or something, I knew. But anytime you address someone, something, some idea that is not present with you, it's really an apostrophe. Now, where the name comes from, I couldn't tell you. From Greek, I guess. But,
again.
you know, it's not that little mark that people misuse when you're talking about poetry. I realized that through the course of, in my writing life, I've written a lot of apostrophes, not knowing necessarily the name for it. But I think the first one that I can think of is Dear John, Letter to My Uterus, which was an apostrophe. Yeah, I've done it many times. And this book is full of them.
It is. So just to, so the definition of it is a poem to a, either a dead person or a absent person, or even a concept, right?
It can be to, I have written to my, well, to my uterus, to a part of your body. I've written, I think, to my piriformis muscle in another book. You know, and in a way, it might have a bit of a, depending on how the poem comes out, it could be sort of like an ode, you know, like Neruda's Ode to Salt or something like that. But that would, you know, indicate it's positive. It may not be a positive thing. Yeah, I've, you know, to my husband a lot, but you can, I know the first apostrophe I wrote, the very first, if I can say it now. Dear God, I wish I had an original sin. You must be bored as hell. Amen.
Great.
So, I mean, great. Thinking back about the apostrophe, I realized that was the first time I did it. I, you know, it was just a joke.
Right.
But great. I thought, you know, what sin is original after the first original? Right. Seen it all, done it, I know.
It's hard to be original even in our sinning. Right. Well, there are three poems in here that are dear blank, you know, dear... Dear Lori, I think there are two other dears. And I don't know if those just sort of come to you or if you thought of those in conversation with each other. They're kind of spread out from each other.
I didn't at the time. At the time of writing, I didn't think of them in conversation with one another, but in the act of ordering the poems, maybe not so much with each other, but with the other poems in the section. Did you want me to read one of these?
I was going to say, could you read Dear Sadness? Because I, it's so, so lovely.
Dear Sadness, you live in a saddlebag cinched to my hip by sinew and bone. To walk with you is hard. Please forgive my complaint. Others hurt more, I know. When you were fixed between Atlas and Axis, like a petrified necklace, I hurt more. It was hard then to hold up, impossible to turn.
Talk about where that came from and how you, okay, how you worked with it.
Several years ago, I hurt my neck very badly, and it was in the top two cervical vertebrae, which Atlas and Axis.
Oh, wow.
And, but that didn't, you know, I don't, it figured into the writing. I'm not sure exactly when it came in, but I was also, I was at the point of surgery. I was in so much pain. It was really life-changing, traumatic and awful. I had nerve blocks. I had epidurals. It was terrible. I wore neck braces. And then I came across a book talking about how to heal your back pain. And at the same time, I started doing Qigong and working with someone, and it was just, I'm fine. I know how to handle the pain. I'm fine. So the poem, you know, came kind of out of coming out of that great physical pain. which I came to realize was where I carried so much sadness. I was able to trace back every like physiological, skeletal, awful thing that have, you know, happened to me had some origin in a trauma. And just knowing that helped me find a way to deal with the pain. And then where the pain was just sort of, well, it just worked into the poem. I don't know for sure how it happened, but I'm sure I was looking at the picture of my skeleton that the doctor sent me, you know, with the arrow pointing of this is where it is. And it was, oh boy.
Well, it's fun. As you're talking, it occurs to me how beautiful, if you get into any world, and now I'm thinking the world of human anatomy, but it could be the world of ornithology and birds, it could be anything. But once you're deep, and music especially, once you're deep in that world, the language that opens up to you of all these wonderful words, I had no idea axis and atlas were part of the cervical spine. I didn't, you know. Yeah. What a gift, right? What a gift, these words.
Absolutely. The wealth, I praise it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I study Latin too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I mean, it's a hobby. It's like, you know, crossword puzzles, you know, which was my mother's just was fiendish about. And, you know, she could do them faster and in ink. And, but for me, it's Latin. I continually feel, you know, I am not good at it. I'll tell
you. Is anybody good at Latin? No, but it's wonderful.
Well, I don't know. Or maybe. My best friend's daughter is a classics major in at Berkeley. She's good at it.
Oh,
and she's good Greek, at it. And she dreams in Greek and things like that. But, you know, mere mortals, no.
I was going to say, all right. So there's her, but yeah.
There's her, but, you know. No, it's hard. It's hard, but I love every minute of it. It's like, you know, it's so much fun.
Well, and I was thinking of that with your bird. There's a lot of bird poetry in here. I know you love birds and crows.
I do.
And you can see that throughout, you know, that there's also just amazing language around birds and all the different breeds and types and everything else. So yeah, that's fun.
When I was thinking about majoring in journalism, I had two professors that said, you're a good writer, major in something so you know something when you're trying to write.
Smart. So
I majored in political science instead.
You're talking to a philosophy major, so yeah.
Oh my God, if I had taken philosophy sooner, I would have majored in philosophy, so speaking my language.
My guest today is Donna Hilbert. The collection is Threnody. You're listening to Writers on Writing. Well, you also alerted me to another type of poetry I was not aware of, which is the, and I will completely mispronounce this, but the villanelle.
Oh, that's villanelle? Right.
Yeah, I did not know the villanelle. And so I thought, and there's a wonderful example on page 93. And I thought maybe we could also read that poem and talk a little bit about a villanelle and what it is and how to do it.
Well, so I believe, let's see, I'll have to count the lines myself. 3, 6, 9.
Hopefully there's 19 because that's what it's supposed to have.
Okay. Well, whatever. Yeah, I'm sure it's, I don't write that many of them. So Well, it's a French form, with repeating lines and end rhyme. And I've written a few of them. I don't generally write things in tight forms, but now people write villanelles in a little less rigid. There are a couple of really famous ones. One Art by Elizabeth Bishop. Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night by Dylan Thomas. And then I believe by Theodore Retke, there's another one. I'm going to fail at saying the name. My Papa's Waltz.
Okay.
Those are probably the most famous.
So it's a 19 lines, and then what are the other rules? It has to have.
Oh gosh, you're going to make me.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have to look it up.
I'm sorry. You don't have to do that.
The first and third lines rhyme. There are like two end rhymes that are repeated over and over, and then it all comes back in the coda at the bottom.
Okay.
You know, when I'm deciding that I've got a couple of good lines that I can repeat, then I look it up and I, you know, try to. But I can't keep those things in my head. Just, it's fair. Crowded up there. many bottoms in the basket of despair. There are many bottoms in the basket of despair, as many as sparrows dropping, no end in sight, from the wide and deep blue air. And who among us even dare to notice what lies sleeping right beneath us in the basket of despair? Remember the old dog, her shedding hair, the endless sweeping day and night, as if cleaning also cleared the air. I've traveled back roads leading God knows where, without a roadmap, compass, or beam of light. There are many blind spots in the carriage of despair. Once on a riverbank, I thought I had lost you, aware of what might swipe you from my watchful sight. I feared you swallowed by the wide and deep blue air. I'm marking time now, trying just to bear nightmare days and sleepless nights, lying with the borders in the casket of despair, uncountable as dust motes in the wide and deep blue air.
I have to just call out that line, casket of despair. I think that's so beautiful. Like, I feel like that could be the title of a something. That's so beautiful.
Thank you.
So in the middle of the poem, and for, you know, this is hard to do on the radio because no one can see it, but there's a line right in the middle, the endless sweeping, then there's a comma, then there's a paren, day and night, end paren, and then the line breaks. And I thought, that's so brilliant and something I and maybe other prose writers would never think of doing, that really elegant placing of a comma, then a paren, which in prose feels like you're breaking so many rules, and in poetry feels just right. I was wondering if there's anything you could say about that, maybe even to prose writers who aren't necessarily poets, but about doing really interesting things with punctuation that can communicate something that I think prose writers might be afraid of doing. Or maybe I'm reading this whole line totally wrong. I don't
know. Well, I wanted to indicate that the things in the parentheses were asides, kind of, if I were breaking the, you know, the, what do they call it? The
wall
on the play. Yeah. So they're a little bit, they're asides. I'm kind of, punctuation is really important to me.
Yeah, I can tell.
And it will drive me crazy until I've got it what I think is right. And I try to do it in a standard way, unless I have a really good reason for not doing so. I believe in the Oxford comma.
Thank you. Thank you.
I just see no reason not to punctuate, because many like to eschew punctuation entirely and just have it on the page. But that to me is ironing everything out in a way that you lose the structure of a dominant clause. You lose the structure of the poem. It's just, now some people can do it. People will say, oh, but Merwin. Okay. But you know, you might not be W.S. Merwin. And if you, you're not going to know whether you are or not, ever, because you'll be dead before anybody knows that. So in the meantime, punctuate. That's my opinion. And I'm full of opinions.
Actually, since you brought that up, one question has been nagging at me for poets and maybe prose writers too, but mostly poets. As you teach, and I know you teach a lot, are there things you advise against new poetry students to say, you know, don't try this at home, kids? You know, you're really...
Oh, yes. There are many things.
Many things.
Yeah. And I'm famous for, not famous, but I mean, with students for saying, don't say first light in a poem. And yes, there are, you know, poets I love who do that. But the first contest I ever judged, I swear every third manuscript had a poem that either began with first light or had that phrase in there.
Really?
Yeah, really. And so I said, don't do it. Don't do it. Just don't. So now every time somebody comes up with a poem from a poet that they know I love, they'll point out that first line. And I had one student even write a poem about first lights, like the first time you light a cigarette, the first light you run. It was very clever. So, well, but I asked them to avoid things that they've heard before. I advised them to begin poems in medias res, not ab ovo. Begin in the middle, not from the egg.
Okay.
And my new publisher, Eric Morago, Moontide Press, said, you know, it's like going to a party, come late and leave early. And I advise you to do the same thing with a poem. Do not give us the prehistory. Just start with what's happening right then and get out of it before you have the impulse to tell what the poem means. Stanley Kunitz said, end on an image and don't explain.
Oh, I love
of course,
that.
There are times when that, you know, you don't do that. You do tell something. But as a guideline, that is a really good one.
So does most of this happen in the revision, and you do tend to, or poets do tend to overwrite at the beginning and then cross out and say, okay, I really can lose that whole first stanza and I can start here?
Yes. Okay. That is pretty much the way it happens. Lots of overwriting, lots of, you know, starting two or three stanzas down.
Well, it's a lot of trust to the reader. And in poetry, then the readers often say, I'm scared, or I'm not equipped to read this, you know, I'm not smart enough to read poetry. And so I can see where the new, especially new poets would not trust the reader for that very reason. And, you know, why don't I just tell you what the poem is about, right?
And that's the biggest mistake you can make, because if you have to tell someone what the poem is about, why write a poem? Write an essay, use another form. I remember how ill-equipped I felt when I first started reading poetry. I thought, I don't understand, you know, half of what is going on here, but I kept reading. And at some point I realized some of my problem with understanding the poem is not my problem. It's the problem of the poet. They're trying to obfuscate or trying to be too smarty pie or something. Or perhaps, you know, perhaps I'm just not tuned into what they're doing. I mean, that can be the part of the reader too. I know poems that I liked in my, well, that's not entirely true. Different poets for different readers. And that is just fine. You don't have to please everyone. Not everyone has to understand you. And neither do you have to like everything you read, even if other people love it. Poems that spoke to me when I was like a lovesick kid, they don't speak to me now. I'm not that person. You know, but there are poems that spoke to me in the very beginning that still do. And I go back and back and back, and that's wonderful. Can't please everybody. It's just like life.
Damn it. Yeah.
Oh, damn it. I want to be loved universally. Right. But I don't, you know, feel like I have to love universally. So there's a problem.
Right. There was a poem that we were talking about yesterday. It's called Grief. And it's so perfectly small. I will let you read it, and then maybe we can.
Grief. In the dishwasher, nothing but spoons.
It's floating in white space because the facing page is completely blank. And obviously these seven words on this page leave a lot of white space. And it's so, it just feels like you've just been punched in the gut to me. As we were just talking about, get in the middle and leave, you know, leave the party early. This poem just feels like it embodies that whole idea.
We only had time to hang up the coat.
Exactly. Right. Yes. You walked in the door, you looked around and you were like, I'm out of here. So I don't know if in something like this, you said this poem, you never were inclined to write over it or to keep going. But I think it's a good place to talk about when to end a poem a little more, you know, when you know you're done with something. And you had some really nice insights about when you know you're done with something. And I was wondering if you could share how you do.
Absolutely. No, I had no desire to go back because the more current grief that I've had reminded me of earlier grief. I mean, I'm literally looking in the dishwasher and I realize everything that I have eaten was eaten with a spoon out of a carton, probably. I mean, just to me, that said grief more than anything that I could elaborate. It's just trying to stay alive, but nothing more. And how do I know when a poem is finished? I'm a pretty fierce editor of my own work. And when I think that it's finished, I leave it on my desk. I mean, I've gotten to the computer by this time and made it probably who knows? I mean, I might have 100 drafts. I might have more. I might not, but you never know. Every time I change a word, I redo it. And that word can be an if, and, or a but. Well, and but, they're not interchangeable, so probably wouldn't be that. But okay, the poem, Dear Lori, is an example. In the last line, I think it goes, never to expect at one point, but my last change after I turned in the manuscript was to change the never to a not. Now, this may not seem monumental, but it was to me. And I was just like, oh, what if I can't change it? What if I can't change it? But I got it in time. That poem was probably the last one I sent in with the manuscript. Now, normally, it would be sit on my desk when I think it's done for about a month, at least. I'd look at it, I'd read it over, and then I would catch the things like the next or nots or a comma, tiny changes. Some of the changes are not so tiny. I might realize that there is a line that just doesn't advance the poem and it'll have to go. Or I have not exited the party quite fast enough and there's a line at the end that doesn't belong. So if I'm working on a reasonably short poem, I will say it to myself as I am falling asleep at night. And the part that I can't quite remember, I will revisit and see if it needs to come out in the morning. I trust that, you know, I will remember that till morning. And I usually do. Because, you know, in the final instance, when a poem isn't finished until the music is right. And if the music isn't right, the poem's not right. And if there isn't something in the poem that's memorable, better be a pretty big something memorable, and then the poem's not right.
How many poems did not make it into the collection that you thought might?
None.
Okay.
Because any poem that I don't think is not right, it's never in contention.
Okay.
I work on one book at a time, and it's not like leftovers. So I'm starting from scratch every time. Now, there may be some impulses toward poems that didn't make it in. I mean, there might be quite a few of those, but they never got to the computer stage. They're just in notebooks, of which I have many.
Many, yeah,
many. Right. So there's still things I hope someday I can have in a poem. In my last book, there was a poem that I wanted very much to write from the time the incident happened, which was early in my married life. And I didn't have the final piece of that poem until I reread the Joyce story, The Dead. Mm. And then I knew how to write the poem after that. Well, it was 30 years in coming. So I'm so glad I was able to write that poem. The thing that had happened in the poem was so meaningful to me, but I just didn't know what to do with it. And then I did. Dear Lori was a little bit like that too, in a way.
Yeah, let's talk about that poem, because at first there's a reference to Birds to America. So I thought it was Lori Moore that you were writing to. And I assume there's some sort of
No, not at all. But, you know, I can understand why that would, yeah, that never occurred to me.
Never? No, really?
I mean, it occurs to me now, of course. But no, because this is my friend's actual name.
Right.
It's Dear Lori because he's a beloved person.
Right. But it's the Birds to America right there. So I couldn't help myself.
No, that's, you know, honestly. But yeah, that's the kind of thing that could have informed me at another point, you know, but this was Lori, and that was the book she gave me.
So funny. Well, Lori Moore spells her name differently. So it all worked
out.
She
does. She does. Do you want me to read that one?
Yeah, let's read that one. It's okay.
And then I will tell you what sparked the poem, how I was able to finally write the poem when I learned something. And this was, the last poem I wrote for the book. And well, try not to cry, because this one makes me cry. Dear Lori, to identify the birds singing from the power lines, I pull Birds of America from its spot atop the bookshelf. Remember, friend, when you gave this book to me, before your move to Texas, Or was it after the returning to California? Your grandmother's book, you said, she who also loved to name the birds. How I grieved when you moved halfway across the country with your family for your husband's better job. I boarded the plane with your baby, barely 3 months old, while you wrangled the other children up the ramp. It was December. Remember how we cried? The new year began, and with it, grief began in earnest. Jobs soured, friends divorced. In May, my father died. When school was out to staunch my tears, Larry loaded our boys into the car. Which car? I don't remember. And we crossed the desert states, craters, canyons, caverns, kitsch motels. The kids counted dead critters on the highway all the way to Texas. Hellish hot, the Texas summer. But Lori, you and I were glad to sit in misery together. We passed the baby back and forth, refilled our icy drinks. The children, keeping cool, wielded water guns and hoses. The husbands talked sports, flipped burgers on the grill. It was June. Did we celebrate our birthdays one day apart, together? I don't remember the birds in Texas, but mosquitoes and chiggers ruled the grass. Cicadas swarmed the backyard trees, a visitation we'd not expected with its symphony of sizzle and buzz, as if a world were ending or beginning. We could not have guessed which guests would call upon us next. Some callers, it's best not to expect.
Talk about where that poem came from.
Lori's been a lifelong friend. We survived every crisis together. She grew up with my husband, and it had been his parents' deepest wish that she would marry him or one of his brothers. And all they talked about was, you know, little Lori Webb. And so I was positioned really to think, I'm going to pull her hair out. We met. We just fell in love. And I don't know how we would have raised our children without one another. You know, we've been side by side for the tragedies that have befallen us. I could write many poems to her. But when she moved to Texas, or one of the moves, she gave me this particular book. I kind of started a poem. And then when the cicadas came for their visit, you know, this past summer or whenever it was, I remembered that that's what was going on the trip to Texas. And then the whole poem fell in place. Mm. I mean, I'm many drafts, of course, but fell into, I knew what to do.
You knew the shape of the poem.
I knew the shape of the poem. I knew where it was going. I knew how to get there. I didn't know exactly where. I had a map.
Right.
Because I never really know where it's going. If I know where it's going, I am much too bored to write it, because that's just not fun.
But this is one of the last poems that you did for this collection.
It is. Yeah. Okay. It is.
Okay.
And I wanted her to read it before I, you know, turned it in, because it's, you know, it's about her. It's a love poem to a dear friend.
Right.
She was happy.
I'll bet. But she was, especially now that we all think she's Lori Moore. No, I'm just
indeed.
Well, tell me a little bit about ordering the collection, because it's told, the collection is in five parts. And you can really see, you know, there are poems about your mom, there are poems about your husband, a lot of poems about, you know, the birds around your house. And obviously they mean much more than birds. There are some beautiful cooking poems. But tell me a little bit about ordering the collection, and, you know, because poems, I think, have to speak on their own, and they have to speak in conversation with each other. And those are two very different things.
They are.
I imagine, knowing you as I do, that you really were ripping your hair out about how to...
It's funny. Well, ordering is not the hardest part for me. In fact, I have bragged about it a bit, how much I enjoy it. I mean, I really do enjoy doing it. So I picked up a couple of jobs doing it for others.
Don't put that on the air. You're going to get calls.
Well, it'll cost you.
Yes.
I do enjoy it. I mean, I spread everything out on a big table and just start making piles. I like sectioned books. When I'm reading one, I like the sections because I would like to be able to read a section, put it down and do whatever I have to do and come back and know where I am. I don't want poems that are too similar to be right next to each other. I would like for the themes to carry through the entire book, but not necessarily be side by side. This book is pretty darn serious, and there's only three poems or four that are not. You know, I used to write a lot more funny poems. I wish I still could.
It was not a funny year. Yeah,
right. It was not a funny year. No, it was not a funny year. And it followed some years for me that were really difficult years. It's an instinct. I can't really say how it needs to be done, except that you don't want two poems that are too much alike right next to one another. And I think a little bit of a narrative thread going through. I started the book with a tiny poem about herons. And then I think the last poem is also herons, if I'm not mistaken. It is. So yeah. I've got herons in the front and herons in the back.
Yeah.
So I did want, the small poems that sort of, the culling, I think set the tone.
Yeah.
And there's just a slight bit of redemption in the last poem. And I wanted that. I like tiny poems. I always have. And I'm glad they're getting a little more acceptance as being for real.
Well, we're drawing down on our time, and maybe we end with that last poem. I'd love to hear you. Because it is a nice little redemptive poem.
Lines ending with Rumi. Heron feeding nestlings in the redbud tree brings me to my knees. There are many ways to kneel and kiss the ground.
And we should point out that there's a lot of photography and maybe some drawings punctuating a lot of these poems, a lot of bird photography and drawings. And you were the photographer, yeah?
Yes, I was. They're all photos. They're no drawings, actually. But I tried to make them look like drawings.
Yeah, the one on page 25 really looks like, I thought that was a drawing. I thought that was like an ink sketch.
Not a drawing in there.
Wow.
I am a frustrated drawer.
We all are. Yeah, I think we all are. Right.
I really, if I could start all over and have another life, I would like to have several, actually. But I'd like one as a visual artist.
Yeah, these are really lovely.
Thank you.
All photography. That's really amazing.
All photography.
Amazing. Amazing.
That's been my other COVID hobby besides Latin, which I take up Latin every time, every time I'm not writing enough. But the photography is pretty new for me since I got an iPhone. The iPhone 10, which I'm going to upgrade, is just so wonderful. I just can't help myself.
These were all taken with an iPhone?
All taken with an iPhone. Every one of them. And edited usually with Snapseed, or I usually can't. I did the cover photo too.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Yes. I wish people run out and buy this book, because really these are really incredible. It's incredible. It's amazing.
I'm so thrilled to be able to take the photo and have it. And I made it into a, painting, like with my own little own apps, but I have no idea how I did it actually.
You are a drawer. You didn't know, but you are. That's impressive. Well,
with the phone.
Yeah. Yeah. And before we sign off, I'd love for you to talk just a little bit about Moontide Press, because we have had a couple of Moontide Press authors on the show, and I don't think that's who published Gravity, as I recall.
No, it was Tabat Bach.
Right. Right. And so if there's anything you can say about working with them and the kinds of poetry.
Oh my gosh. It's like, someday your prince will come, Working with Eric Morago at Moontide Press is just pure joy. He's smart, funny, does what he says he's going to do in a timely fashion. It is just pure pleasure. And many of the writers that he has brought together I just love. And it's been completely joyful experience. Moontide Press rocks. I recommend everyone go on their website and look and see what a really diverse, exciting group of poets that Eric Morago has brought together.
And they're not all California, right?
They're not all California, but there's definitely a lean toward California. It's just, I couldn't ask for more.
Yeah, I love to plug these small presses because, they do such great work, such interesting work. And I think that's great.
They absolutely do. And I'd like to say, if you like the work of any small press poet, boy, if you can give an Amazon review, you are just, it's gold.
Okay.
And I know not everybody is crazy about Amazon, but it's a reality of life. This is where most people are buying their books, and 5-star reviews are just priceless.
Good. Okay. Good advice. Yeah, you're right. That's the world we live in. And don't buy it from Amazon, but review it on Amazon.
Exactly. That works for me.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Is there advice that you give new poets, old poets that you feel like we didn't get in here today?
Oh, yeah. I do have a bunch of advice, actually.
Good.
One, as you can remember it easily, ABG, always be gracious. Don't be petulant. Be grateful every time you're published. Do not be resentful when you're not. And work, read everything you can get your hands on. Learn from what you don't like. Learn from what you love. It takes a long time to become everything you might be as a poet. Do not be impatient. Don't be impatient with yourself. If it's in you to get there, you'll get there. And it's not about, be in love with the process. If you're not in love with the process, find something else to do, because you've got to really love what you're doing to be able to stick it out. Every day I wake up, I love what I do. I don't want to do anything else.
Would you keep doing this if you knew you could never publish another collection again? Would you still keep going?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be published. I want to be, of course. It has nothing to do with what I do, however.
Okay.
I do what I do because that's who I am. It's how I organize the world. It's how I think. I wouldn't do anything else.
Good.
Nope.
Yeah. Good. Keep doing it, because
I intend to. I'm thinking about the next one now.
Yeah, we got more to talk about.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Donna Hilbert, this was such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marie.
That was Donna Hilbert. Her latest collection of poetry is Threnody. You can find this and other episodes on our websites. Barbara's is barbaranamarcobarrett.com. Mine is mariestone.com. You can also follow us on iTunes, Amazon, and Stitcher, Writers on Writing. Music, sound design, and editing was provided by Travis Barrett. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.